I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Some Missourians have waited years for a chance to vote on medical marijuana. This election season, those voters are faced with a dilemma. On November 6th, they will have three options on the ballot. Today, a look at what brought this push to legalize weed for medical use and the chances that any or all of the proposed initiatives passing. Then, whoever said that Kansas City is just strip malls and business parks? People live here, and throughout its history, some beautiful and majestic homes have been designed and built. We'll hear stories behind some of the most exquisite examples as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Back in 2016, advocates of a medical marijuana ballot initiative in Missouri tried but couldn't gather enough signatures to get it on the ballot. This year, well, Missourians will have their choice of, count them, three initiatives. Only one ballot initiative of the three would permit patients to grow their own weed. The three tax medical marijuana at different levels and send the proceeds to different places. Finally, two of the three are constitutional amendments, while just one is a new state law. Yes, it's confusing, but we're going to try mightily here to sort it out for our listeners this morning. With us to do just that are Alex Smith. He's a health reporter for KCUR. Alex, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
Chris Crane writes about the cannabis industry for Forbes and is executive director of Forefront Ventures. That's a leading investment and operations firm in the legal cannabis industry. Chris has worked on regulatory and business strategy with cannabis business operators across the U.S. as well as globally. Chris, nice to have you too. Good morning.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Alex, what happened here? I mean, how did Missouri go from seeing a medical marijuana issue fail to even make the ballot 2 years ago to now seeing three initiatives going before voters all at once?
Well, yeah, that's right. As you mentioned, in 2016, there was a petition that just didn't get enough signatures to get on the ballot. And I think this year, the advocates are really just much more organized and better funded. And I think also the medical marijuana industry is getting bigger and more influential. And even though there's not a lot of transparency in the campaigns or the funding, I think it's a pretty safe bet that they are doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes to really push for this.
And Alex, just remind us, where is Kansas on medical marijuana? Is there anything that has passed the legislature over there?
Well, yeah, medical marijuana is not legal in Kansas. There have been proposed bills to make that happen, but it's just been slower going than in Missouri.
Okay. Well, Chris, seven states passed medical marijuana issues in 2016, and 30 states have legalized marijuana for medical use. So what, safe to say here, this is a growing trend across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this would not put Missouri outside of the mainstream in the United States. In fact, it would actually bring Missouri in line with the overwhelming majority of the country today. The first medical marijuana law was adopted by ballot initiative in California back in 1996 with Proposition 215. And as you mentioned, we're over 30 states at this point. So this would certainly bring Missouri in line with where the majority of the country is if one or more of these initiatives are to pass.
I mean, what's happened, Chris, you know, out across the country that's made the idea of medical marijuana acceptable to so many Americans?
Well, it works, for one. It's an effective remedy for a lot of conditions where people are typically treated with opiates or other harsher pharmaceuticals. I think there was a lot of awareness raised over the last decade or so, particularly about the use of CBD, which is one of the components in medical cannabis for the treatment of Dravet syndrome and youth onset epilepsy. You had attention brought to people that were called marijuana refugees who had to leave their states to go live in Colorado because it was the only place they could access the medicine that helped them and helped their children. This is an issue that's about compassion. It's about getting people a product that that can help them alleviate serious medical conditions. And that's why we see upwards of 80 to 85% support when the country is polled on this.
But Chris, isn't the big concern out there that if you pass medical marijuana, that's just going to be a precursor to ultimate passage of recreational marijuana use?
I mean, I don't see that as a valid concern. I mean, look, if in the end, if people get exposed to the fact that cannabis can be produced and distributed in a way that is professional and responsible, and they get used to seeing that in their communities, and that opens their minds to some sort of further reform, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but it's not the goal of these initiatives. The goal of these initiatives is to make sure that people who need cannabis for medical purposes have access to it. It's basic compassion. It's basic human rights. And again, it's the reason why basically every medical marijuana ballot initiative that's been put on the ballot everywhere around the country have passed with a few small exceptions, and none, I believe, going back to 2010 have failed. And when voters are polled on this, the polling is overwhelming in support of this. It's very difficult to be opposed to providing relief to patients with serious illnesses.
So you see this as two different issues.
I see them as related issues, but okay. to say that by legalizing marijuana for medical purposes and providing patients with access to a safe and effective medicine, it might be a stepping stone to some sort of further legalization, I don't see that as a legitimate argument. We're not going to deny an effective treatment to people just because there's a possibility that down the road it could help lead to some sort of further legalization. I think that would be tremendously unfair to those patients who've been waiting far too long in Missouri for access to their medicine.
We're talking about three proposals going before Missouri voters in November to legalize medical marijuana. Alex, just so I get it here, if a Missouri resident is in pain or is suffering from seizures and a doctor thinks that, you know, smoking marijuana would help, that patient today can't legally get a supply of marijuana?
That's right. I mean, aside from state laws, since Missouri is illegal under federal law, I mean, doctors can't prescribe it or even advise patients on how to use it. In fact, that's even true in states that have legal medical marijuana. Those doctors in those states can only legally write recommendations for then people to go get it, access to it someplace else.
And so the medical argument for medical marijuana, Alex, is what then?
Well, there is some pretty good research showing that it can help people with some conditions like epilepsy or chronic pain, although other doctors say that's not totally definitive. And again, because marijuana is illegal federally, it's been hard for researchers to study it in the U.S., and a lot of the research that's out there and that we know about actually happens in other countries.
I was going to say, Chris, there's some research out there that suggests that scientists don't really yet understand the biology of cannabis. In fact, Jennifer Lowry, the chief toxicologist at our big Children's Mercy Hospital here in Kansas City, just told the newspaper that there are pros here that include pain relief, as well as cons that include mood and anxiety disorders that might stem from use of marijuana. What about that?
Well, I would say there are cons associated with just about every type of any type of medicine. I mean, if you look at just about any pharmaceutical commercial, the last half of the commercial is warnings about potential side effects, many of which are potentially worse than the condition for which the pharmaceuticals are treating in the first place. So to say that there are some potential negative side effects to cannabis is not outside the mainstream of what we're used to when it comes to medicines and remedies. And in fact, I would say those cons are far outweighed by the potential benefits that we see from medical cannabis for many of these patients. As far as the research goes, there is a lot of research that's been done out there. I mean, your other guest is right that much of this is done outside of the United States. But going all the way back to 1972, when marijuana was first put in Schedule I, President Nixon commissioned a presidential level commission. It was called the Schaefer Commission. They came back after 2 years of study and said definitively that marijuana has medicinal value. And just about every panel that's looked at this going back to 1972 has found some medicinal value in cannabis. So maintaining marijuana as Schedule I, meaning that it has a high potential for abuse and no recognized medicinal value, just flies completely in the face of all of the evidence that we've seen out there over the last 40 to 50 years.
So what's your sense, Chris, for why this has been such a long battle in this country? And why is it that states like Missouri and Kansas continue to resist?
Well, it's you know, we're fighting against a very ingrained sort of propaganda campaign that's gone back more than a century. You know, when people grow up in programs like the DARE program and grow up with drug education and grow up being told that marijuana is evil and bad and does all these horrible things, and they don't have the exposure to it in a legal and regulated environment, those stereotypes really set in. I think what we've seen now over the last 20 years with the proliferation of medical marijuana laws around the country is that more and more Americans have gotten exposure to what legal medical marijuana looks like. And when they see what that looks like, their minds change, right? It counteracts those stereotypes that have been driven into them from when they were very young. And I think it's why we're seeing such overwhelming support. In a state like Kansas, you know, part of the reason why we haven't seen this yet is it is a relatively conservative state. The Republican Party has not been as quick to embrace this as the Democratic Party, although that is changing. There is a lot of bipartisan support for this, so I don't mean to make it a partisan issue here. But Kansas, I believe, is a state without a ballot initiative process. So it's harder to get some of these laws passed generally through state legislatures, particularly conservative-controlled legislatures by and large, although not entirely. Most of the laws have been passed through ballot initiatives or through Democratic-controlled legislatures. Missouri is actually going to be one of the last states with a ballot initiative process to pass one of these laws.
I was going to say, is there a pattern, Chris, to the location of the states that have not passed medical marijuana ballot initiatives of one kind or another? Are most of these states in the Bible Belt, or what do you see?
They are in the, by and large, in the plains states and in the south. Right now, the entire West Coast, the entire Northeast, pretty much the entire Midwest outside of Wisconsin has some kind of medical marijuana law in place. But most of the center of the country, the plains states in particular, and some of the south have not adopted this yet, although that's changing as well. Arkansas has a robust medical marijuana program that they're issuing licenses for. Florida has a very robust medical marijuana program that passed overwhelmingly by ballot initiative. Then even a state like Mississippi is considering a medical marijuana ballot initiative for the 2020 elections. And just earlier this year, during the primary elections, which tends to in more conservative states, the primaries tend to skew much more conservative. A medical marijuana ballot initiative passed overwhelmingly in Oklahoma. You don't get much more deep red than Oklahoma, especially during a primary initiative run during the primary. So I think that showed us that this is not a bipartisan issue. Maybe a little bit amongst the electorate, but not amongst elected officials, but not amongst the public. The public is there on this issue. It doesn't matter if they're conservative, liberal, Democrat, or Republican. And I think the voters will reflect that come November in Missouri.
So you think it's going to pass?
I'm very hopeful. My only concern is that there are three initiatives on the ballot, which means there's a possibility that they all split the votes and none of them pass. That would be my fear, although I think support for medical marijuana is high enough in Missouri as it is around the country that at least one, if not multiple, of these initiatives will pass, which will, of course, create its own issues.
Yes, right. We're going to talk about those three ballot initiatives right now. Again, that was the voice of Chris Crane. He writes about the cannabis industry for Forbes. He's executive director for Forefront Ventures. Alex Smith also joins me here in studio, a health reporter for KCUR. If you have questions about these three initiatives, they are confusing. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Alex, let's, if we can, briefly walk through these three initiatives, and maybe you can give us three or four bullet points for each one of these things. The first one is Amendment 2.
Sure. Amendment 2 is sponsored by New Approach Missouri, which is a St. Louis group, and it would legalize medical marijuana and create a 4% sales tax, which would fund veterans programs. It would also allow people to grow medical marijuana for themselves, not necessarily in their backyard garden, but in licensed facilities.
Okay. How about Amendment 3? What makes that one stand out?
So Amendment 3, this is sponsored by Brad Bradshaw, who is a well-known personal injury lawyer and doctor who's based in Springfield. It would create a 15% sales tax. That would be the highest tax in the country for medical marijuana. And that would fund a medical marijuana research center to fund cancer research. And this is primarily been supported by Bradshaw himself, who would also, at least in the beginning, be the head of that research facility.
Okay, and then both these first two proposals are constitutional amendments, big change to the state constitution. This third proposal is a change to state law and not a constitutional amendment, right?
That's right. Yeah, this is Missourians for the Patient Care Act. It would create the smallest sales tax, just 2%. And as you said, this would just create a state law, so it could be easily changed by lawmakers. And its supporters say that that is actually a real plus, a real benefit, because that would give the state a lot of flexibility on just how they want to implement this and what they want it to look like.
This is a new industry, so some changes might be coming down the road, perhaps,
right,
in the years to come.
Yeah.
Okay, that helps a lot sort of sort all this through. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to Joe from Lenexa. Joe, good morning.
Good morning. Good show. Medical marijuana, if I was to use that to treat a condition, I would not want the side effect of being stoned or the effect of the THC. I know that there's a component in marijuana that can help medical conditions that doesn't involve the THC. Can you kind of give a list of medical conditions that can be treated with marijuana without the THC, and which medical conditions need to be treated with the THC?
Chris, can you take that one?
Sure. So it's kind of two questions there. I mean, in terms of what can be treated with THC and what can be treated with CBD, cannabidiol.
Just give us 101 definitions here. THC and CBD, what are we talking about here?
Sure. So THC and CBD are the two primary cannabinoids found in marijuana, in cannabis. THC is what most people are familiar with. It's what gets people, quote unquote, high,
okay,
or creates the intoxicating euphoric effect. CBD is non-intoxicating. It does have medicinal benefits, but so does THC. And, you know, what we're actually finding, and I will say the research on this is still relatively new, but what we're finding is that CBD is particularly effective for treating intractable pain, muscle spasms, a number of other conditions. But what we are finding is that CBD on its own, while somewhat effective, is generally not nearly as effective without some THC in the preparation as well as some of the other cannabinoids. There are 60 or so cannabinoids in cannabis, many of which we haven't even identified what they are yet. But it's the entourage effect of the various cannabinoids and terpenes, which are some of the other chemicals found in cannabis, that seem to be the most effective. So what I would say is...
Let me slow you down here. And in Missouri, would Missouri's three proposals each allow for a THC component in the medical marijuana that
yes,
would be obtained?
They all would, yes. They would all allow for marijuana in various forms. So, you know, what I would recommend for a caller like this would be to find either a strain or a preparation of cannabis. And a lot of this is non-smoked now. It can be ingested orally, drank as various edibles, tinctures, and so forth. But to find a preparation that is high in CBD with a small amount of THC, that amount will not be enough to get you, quote unquote, high. But it does play a role in helping activate the medicinal benefits of CBD.
Okay. Let's go back to some calls. And David from the West Plaza neighborhood, we're talking about medical marijuana on the Missouri ballot. David, good morning.
Well, I think the issue of the legalization of marijuana really is a civil rights issue, because just like laws in pair that make voting harder, they inordinately affect people of color, so has the marijuana laws. I'm a white male in my 60s, and I have experiences when I was much younger. And, you know, people just didn't get busted for marijuana. But I think today, you know, we're putting a lot of people in jail and giving them felonies on their records over marijuana. And, you know, the money that we could make on taxes from the marijuana, and then the money we'd save not putting people in prison. You know, every day we have somebody in Jackson County lockup down there for marijuana, it's costing us $80 a day.
Right.
So I think if you look at all that, but my main push, it's a civil rights issue, just like laws that make voting harder, they affect
right,
people of color, so do these laws against marijuana do.
David, thanks for your comments. I appreciate it. I'm going to have to move on here. Gareth from Smithville, good morning.
Good morning. Just had one quick question.
Yes,
with
sir.
Respect to the three ballot initiatives on the Missouri ballot, if all three pass, do we know what the process becomes for legalization at that point?
Alex Smith, that's maybe the question I was going to get to here at some point. What happens if all three pass?
Well, yeah, I've been on the phone a few times the past couple of weeks with state officials on this. And the law seems to say that any time conflicting ballot measures pass, then the one with the most votes wins. But there is some unclear and possibly conflicting language about what happens when one measure is an amendment and another measure is a statute. So this will probably end up going to court.
Goody. More uncertainty going forward. That's what we all like to see here in Missouri. Let's keep going here and go to Murad from Independence. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
You bet.
And I'm listening to what's going on here, and this is the thing I have to say. It is a shame that we have to pander to the idea of people who want to control other people's lives. We've had marijuana in our society for generations. We know what it does. The idea that doctors can't even investigate and do research is just a ridiculous proposition, and it's 2018.
Murad, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Laura from North Kansas City. Laura, you're on Up to Date.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am just really concerned about these, the two amendments and the Proposition C, just because they're very, very broad medical marijuana. I think just the fact that there's three of them shows that there's just money behind these to me. And I'm concerned two of them say that people will be able to access marijuana for it. They list some conditions, but then they also say, and any other condition. So, I mean, you could tell a doctor that your fingernails hurt and they could prescribe you or recommend, they don't prescribe, but recommend you marijuana. And then I'm also concerned, and I don't know if it's been brought up yet, but just the potent pot edibles that will be legalized, that, you know, can be 60 to 90% THC and come in the forms of candies, cookies, gummy bears, ice cream, and the waxes, the high potent waxes. I just think that those are really dangerous for our kids. They come in packaging right. That is appealing to our youth. So those are some of my concerns, that this is just a different, this is not right. Just the medicine that you think, how we think of medicine.
Laura, thank you. And I'm wondering, Chris, maybe you can give us some context here. Are edibles, could they be sold legally under these laws?
So I believe so. Alex may be able to walk through the difference between the three initiatives better than I can. But by and large, when it comes to a robust medical marijuana law like we're talking about here, edibles are allowed. Now, that said, there are fail-safes around some of those concerns. And we're seeing that in a lot of the states that have both medical laws and some adult use laws. And that can be dealt with largely through regulation. So in most states now, what we're seeing are caps on the potency level of edibles. So you have to standardize doses. So no one package could have, in most cases, it's more than 100 milligrams of THC, but it has to be in 5 milligram or 10 milligram doses. So either in individual pieces or perforated pieces. So you know you're not getting more right. than you want. The packaging cannot be, usually it has to be some kind of opaque packaging and not anything that is appealing to children. The packaging itself needs to be childproof or child resistant. And a lot of states will now ban the sale of products that are meant to mimic products that are out there and available to children.
Right.
So no gummy bears or gummy worms, or you know, shapes or animal shapes, that kind of thing.
And Chris, can you give us some context here? What these three initiatives are proposing for Missouri compared to laws in other states? Are the Missouri laws looser? Are they the same? It's very similar to other laws in other states. Are we being more liberal here, more conservative? I don't have any sense of it.
No, I'd say they're fairly in line with the majority of medical marijuana laws.
Okay.
And again, there are some differences between them, right? One allows for home cultivation for patients while others don't. So those would be a little bit more restrictive than what we see. Most medical marijuana laws do have some provision that allow patients to grow their own product at home. But by and large, these initiatives are fairly in line with what we see around the country. There are some states that have more restrictive laws where the qualifying conditions that would allow someone to become a patient are much more restrictive. And those programs tend to have quite a few problems. They don't reach enough patients.
Right.
This would be a little less restrictive than the old laws in California or Colorado, which were probably some of the most permissive in the country, but not as restrictive as a state like, say, a Minnesota or even a New York, where the qualifying conditions and the products are much more restricted.
Alex, again, in an effort to sort of help Missourians sort out these three initiatives, these three proposals here, does one have more endorsements from, say, medical societies than the others? Does one stand out in the endorsement realm in any way?
Well, Amendment 2 does have quite a bit of support. That's New Approach Missouri. Does have quite a bit of support from doctors and patients groups.
That's Amendment 2, you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. The New Approach Missouri, as does Proposition 2. Similar support. Proposition C. Also some similar support from doctors and medical groups. Not quite as much as Amendment 2. Amendment 3, again, Brad Bradshaw is kind of on his own with that one. I haven't seen any endorsements from outside groups.
I'm getting the picture here, I think. Let's go to Aaron from North Kansas City. Aaron, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. With regard to Amendment 2 and I guess the other proposals as well, who oversees the implementation of these, should it pass?
Who's going to regulate these things is what you're wondering, Aaron.
Right. So once it says, like, who determines what medical conditions qualify for medical marijuana?
Gotcha.
Because neither proposal really clarify who will oversee the beginning of this new adventure.
Right.
Should we go down that road?
Aaron, thank you. Help us, Alex.
Well, all of these measures would set up, state groups that would, be in charge of licensing and facilities. Amendment 2 and Amendment 3 are actually both pretty detailed on just how exactly that would work. Again, Proposition C, that's the one that would be amendable by state lawmakers. That one does provide a lot of flexibility for, lawmakers to just set up the state agency as, they see would work best for the state.
Okay. I want to thank Alex Smith, a health reporter for KCUR, for helping us sort through all this. Nice job, Alex. That was a tall order.
Yeah, thank you,
I appreciate
Steve.
It. Chris Crane writes about the cannabis industry for Forbes. He's executive director for Forefront Ventures. Chris, you were terrific, too. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of Kansas City's classic historic homes. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Claire McCaskill was in the studio yesterday. We started out talking about the Chiefs game and then got down to D.C. politics and campaigning. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Another woman in a tough political race will be here tomorrow, that State Senator Laura Kelly, who's running for governor of Kansas, and we'll ask her about her plans for the state. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas City has got some cool homes, some fantastic homes. A new book out chronicles some of the city's classic domiciles built between 1885 and 1938. Many of you will be familiar with many of them. They include homes built for William Rockhill Nelson, William and Francis Garrett, and Jacob and Ella Luce. The book is meant for your coffee table. The title, Kansas City Houses, 1885 to 1938. And its author is Michael Catherins. He's a scholar who specializes in American residential architecture from the mid-19th through the early 20th century. He's the author of several books, including The Great Houses of New York, and he's now a resident of Kansas City. And Michael, I'm glad you're a resident. Welcome to town. So good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Well, glad the city to be here. Of Kansas was incorporated in 1853. That's only 32 years before your book picks up. That struck me as remarkably fast for these mansions to start appearing around town.
Well, the city really grew really quickly after the Hannibal Bridge. That made the city really grow. We became a boom town. Mm-hmm. And the city grew. So we were bigger than Atlanta. We were bigger than Denver. We were bigger than Dallas. We were bigger than Houston. So the thing is, we became the financial juggernaut of this area.
And there was money here to build these big houses.
Yes, a lot of it. People moved here. Very few people were born here. They moved here because this was the place to be.
Why did you focus on these years, 1885 to 1938? I mean, what was going on then that was special during those years?
Well, it's kind of what I do. That's the era that I specialize in. I've written a couple of books on New York townhouses, one on the summer houses in Newport, Rhode Island, and another book or two. And this is the era that I specialize in. So this is what my research is on. And so I've specialized in this era. And it was an era of a very important period of American history. It was the industrialization of America. So the huge fortunes were made. And it always fascinates me how people decided to live, who made these huge fortunes. How did they want to live? What kind of houses they wanted? So I always enjoyed that.
What distinguishes houses that were built during those years from houses built more recently?
Well, basically, this was an era of historicism. So it was based on predominantly European revival styles, such as Tudor, Georgian, right. Spanish revival. So that kind of was the period that we were in at that time. Although there were individual houses that were built in different, like the Corrigan House, which was done in a kind of a Vienna secession movement, which is a group of artists who worked in Vienna during the time period.
And some houses I noticed in the book, it was hard to categorize them in any way. You couldn't tell what style they were in some cases.
Well,
they were kind of a mix.
Some of them were. They were eclectic houses.
Yes.
But basically the roots of most of the houses, they actually came from some root vocabulary. A lot of Georgian or Baroque houses, English styles, a lot of Tudors. Kansas City is famous for their Tudor-style revivals. And there were eclectic ones, but there were modern ones too, like the Art Modern house for the Bixby House. Bixby, mm-hmm. you know, was the head of a Kansas City Life. So it was an era of experimentation, let's say. And I also like to point out that this historicism was not done just in the United States, but it was done around the world. In Western culture, everywhere, everybody was doing this. So America was not copying anybody else. They were doing what everybody was doing in South America, North America, Europe, all over Europe. So,
how do these houses in Kansas City compare to the rest of the country? I mean, what did you notice there?
Well, the research initially I had done were houses back east. So they tended to be larger back east. They were more grandiose, shall we say, where Kansas Cityans tend to have a certain reticence. There is still today a
Midwestern conservatism.
Reticence,
perhaps.
Yes.
Yeah.
They wanted to be against grandiose living. So Kansas Cityans were doing it in a quieter fashion.
But nonetheless, some of these houses are pretty
magnificent.
Fantastic.
By anybody's standards, they're really magnificent, yes.
I should point out that Michael Catherins will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library's Plaza Branch. The event is sold out, but you can get more information about the book, Kansas City Houses, at kansascityhouses.org. This is a huge book with dozens of homes featured, but if you can, give us a sense of for the kind of men who built these homes, and were they all white men?
Yes, completely.
Yeah.
People you would know, like William Rockhill Nelson, the Skerritt family, which did the Northeast, develop that area because Nathan Skerritt had put a farm up there originally during the Civil War because he had lived in Westport and it was dangerous living on the border between Kansas and Missouri. They called it Bloody Kansas. So he moved his family way up north to be away from that. And then they later, within just a generation, started selling them off to lucratively for these fine houses that were built like on Gladstone Boulevard.
Why did they sell them off?
The lots?
Yeah.
Well, because they just developed. As the city grew, it couldn't be a farm anymore. So it'd be like, it was very, you know, simple. And they were in the right place at the right time, and they knew how to develop the land. And that was what was important.
You know, one notable exception to the Boys Club here is Mary Rockwell Hook. Two of her homes are featured in the book. Tell us who she was, Michael.
Well, Mary Rockwell Hook was the son of Bertrand Rockwell, who was from Garden City, Kansas. And he was a grain merchant and a banker, and he had a fortune there. But he wanted his children to grow up in a more cultured environment. So that's why he moved from there to Kansas City. And he supported all of his children in the careers that they chose. And Mary, at the time, was, the first woman to study at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, which was the world's leading architectural school at the time. So it was kind of an interesting dynamic that went on. She was also very good. She was recycling. She was one of the first to recycle. She would get things from old buildings and recycle them into the building she built. So she did very interesting things, like there was a balustrade over a two-story window, and it was done as a radiator. It was a radiator, but it was a balustrade too. Very unique, interesting details in her house.
How difficult was it for someone like her to find work in this town then?
Initially, it was very difficult for her. People wouldn't hire her. She also, initially, her father said she could be an architect, but she, as being a lady, she could not charge for her services. That later changed. So it was very difficult for her to get started. But once she did, she actually did pretty well. She connected very well. She did a lot of things in Kansas City, and she did a lot of things outside of Kansas City. There's a major estate outside of San Francisco that she built for a sister of hers who had married someone and moved out there, French classical estate. So she did do a lot of work outside of Kansas City as well.
Michael Catherins is my guest. We're talking about some of the great homes of Kansas City. You know, the introduction to the book, Michael, includes so many photos of homes that were ultimately destroyed. These are gigantic, beautiful mansions that once stood where we now have parking lots and apartment buildings, a Mexican restaurant in one instance. How in the world did that happen?
Lack of deed restrictions. So the thing is, the areas, and often within one generation, would be from millionaires' houses to blighted areas within one generation. There was an area on...
You mean the neighborhoods were changing rapidly?
So rapidly, because there were no deed restrictions. So the thing that we have, the Country Club District, Nichols put deed restrictions. So that has kept those intact, and they are still the best neighborhoods to live in Kansas City.
Meaning that like houses were built next to each other, as opposed to some neighborhoods where there'd be a mansion next door to relatively small houses.
It could be small houses, but it could also be converted to businesses. So like on Troost Avenue between 28th Street and 31st Street, there was a group of really large mansions. Not a single one of these exists today. And so in the mid-20th century, they turned to industrial buildings.
And this is what J.C. Nichols realized, these deed restrictions that have proven so controversial over the years.
He did. So basically, I mean, I think his restrictions are still in use in most of his areas today. There was the unfortunate racial restrictions, which was unfortunate, but it was typical of its era. So, but now those no longer in force today. But basically, all the others are there. And he also promoted strong homeowners associations for each neighborhood.
We'll talk more about J.C. Nichols in a little bit here. Let's go to some of the houses that you talk about in the book. Number one is Oak Hall. This was William Rockhill Nelson's home, and it stood on his property at 44th and between Oak and Rockhill Road. The home itself kind of evolved as Nelson's fortunes grew. He obviously was the publisher of the Kansas City Star. How influential was Nelson to developing Kansas City?
He was very instrumental because he felt he actually came from a old established Eastern family and then moved to the I think he lived in the South for a while, but his family had long roots far back in the United States, and he wanted Kansas City to be a cultural center. So he really pushed for the parks and boulevard system. He pushed for any kind of artistic advances in the city and cultural advances. It was very important to him because he wanted to put Kansas City on the map for that. So in his newspaper, he really pushed these topics and subjects because he wanted the city to evolve culturally.
His home originally was shingle style. What does that mean?
It means it's covered in outside in a veneer of shingles. It was a mixture of a stone, but shingle, and it was very prominent in the 1870s and 1880s.
You know, it was her, his only child, Laura Rockhill Nelson, who stipulated that her home, the home be demolished after she and her husband died. Why in the world did she do that?
It's actually what her father wanted as well, because he wanted it, the site to be the site of a museum.
Which is where it is.
The Nelson Atkins Museum. And so that was the reason. And he wanted a new building, which would be more appropriate for an art gallery than his house would not have been.
So the house stood precisely where the art museum is
close
today?
To it. It wasn't precisely, but it was close to it, yes.
Yeah. You say there are several ways that Kansas City homes stand out from similar-sized homes in the Northeast. Let's talk about that just a little bit. For one thing, fewer staff quarters and accommodations?
Well, so what happened in most cities back east, they had a lot more live-in servants. So they would have butlers, maids, footmen, sometimes in liveries. They'd have a valet for the husband, a personal maid for the wife, kind of the Downton Abbey kind of thing.
Yeah.
But in Kansas City, again, because they were against that grandiose living, they didn't employ that. So the occasional butler they had, a few maid of all works, you know, and maybe a chauffeur who lived over the garage, and a cellar man who, for the heavy lifting, would have been in the basement, lived in the basement. But other than that, you didn't have the live-in servants. So therefore, the third floor of most of these houses in the attics would have been servants' rooms. But in this city, and then certainly in other Midwestern cities, because they also didn't have all these servants, they would put what they call ballrooms at the top of the house.
And also lack of fireplaces out here.
Fewer. Yeah, it's interesting, particularly later. Back east, since it was historicism, they took certain styles of interior decoration, and the center of each room would have been a fireplace the architectural center point of the room. And in Kansas City, you didn't have that. So you had, they usually did in the living room. They did, if they had a library, they often did. And once in a while, a master bedroom. But most of the bigger, more important houses back east, they would have them in every important room, like the dining room, music room, and a lot of the bedrooms would all have them. So it was a little different here. And there was no reason. At that time, we had central heating. So there was no reason. They didn't, what didn't affect the how comfortable a house was.
And there were sleeping porches in Kansas City.
A lot of sleeping porches. And lots, that was also because pre-air conditioned era. So it was very important to have that. And also because tuberculosis at that time, they thought it more healthful to sleep in fresh air. So a lot of people slept on these even during the winter months, just got under blankets to sleep in these because they thought it more helpful that they wouldn't get TB.
One final point, local architects were preferred here in Kansas City.
Yes, they were. Once in a while, they would have once in a while, the Luce family brought someone in from Washington, D.C. The Skerritt family brought someone in from Chicago. But basically, the architects that were chosen for the houses featured in the book and were generally used were local architects. They weren't necessarily born and raised here, but their careers were here. They came to Kansas City because the work was here.
Michael Catherins is my guest. His new book is a coffee table book, just gorgeous, Kansas City Houses, 1885 to 1938. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, let's turn to J.C. Nichols and talk about him a little bit more here. You write in the book that no one has done as much for residential development in Kansas City and with such lasting results as J.C. Nichols. But it was a little more complicated than that, too, referring to the racial covenants and everything
else. Well, they were, and it was difficult for them. Well, again, the racial covenant was basically that you would have gone anywhere in the country and in finer neighborhoods, it would have been everywhere. It's unfortunate, but that's the way the world was at that time. Mm-hmm. There is a story, and initially he did. He was anti-Semitic and did not want Jews in his developments. But he quickly learned that that wasn't, he changed his mind on that. He had, there was a man named Booten who did an area called Roland Park outside of, not in Kansas City, it's in Baltimore. And they were best friends and they traded development issues all the time. Booten was very much against having Jews in his developments initially. Mm. But early on, he realized how important the Jewish population was and leaders in the city. So they were actually included. And so you have houses in Mission Hills and all those areas that actually Jews did actually live
in. Where did they get the idea for racial covenants? Do we know?
Well, racial it was because to say property value. So, you know, unfortunately, that's what these are about because they're afraid if you had someone next to you, living next to you, it would bring down your property values. It's not so unusual. It happened in the 60s, even here in Kansas City, where there was the white flight from Kansas City, Missouri. So this is not something new. It just is unfortunate, but I think we're getting out of that now to some extent, which is about time.
Some of these zoning restrictions are still enforced today that came about during Nichols' time?
No, yes. It's mostly about properties. What you can do is you can put on your property. They have to be – there were certain restrictions about how close to the streets you could build your house, no above-ground oil tanks, things of that nature. They're all pretty pedestrian, but they kept the neighborhoods intact so that they remained really nice and visually exciting and pleasant.
You know, you write in here, Michael, that Nichols helped solve a dilemma for the city's wealthiest, which was where to build and where to live. How so?
Well, eventually his country club district, because, again, the previous generations, often within a single generation, if you had come from a wealthy family, your parents' home, you wouldn't live in that neighborhood anymore. Even Armour Boulevard turned to apartments, you know. So the thing is, Jansen Place, which was in the best parts of Hyde Park, by the mid 20th century, had been turned into apartments. So one of the houses, the Pickering House we have in the book, we feature, had 18 apartments in it. So it had been divided up. But so what Nichols did is put these restrictions so these neighborhoods would not go down. And they are still the best neighborhoods to live in Kansas City today.
That's interesting. I mean, housing restrictions weren't new to Nichols. I mean, before that, there were neighborhoods like Quality Hill would require all buildings to be built with brick. What did that mean for the lower and middle classes looking to build in those places?
Well, they couldn't in those neighborhoods, and that was the whole reason for it. They wanted to keep it as an upscale neighborhood so your neighbors would all be affluent.
There's a story in the introduction to the book about a place called Peary Place, which could be the first instance of gentrification in Kansas City. What happened there?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Kersey Coates, some of you may know the Kersey Coates, the Coates Hotel downtown, he came to Kansas City early on and he developed Quality Hill. But a few years later after that, he developed Peary Place and he was a confirmed abolitionist. So he built this neighborhood so that poor African-Americans could live there, and he built a black church and, you know, a black school education. When this was really early, this is in the mid-19th century, so this was very early on it. But unfortunately, as the city grew, the property values started to go up. So the people that owned the houses, because most of these people didn't own them, they rented them, they sold their houses to developers to build more affluent neighborhoods for white families. And so at that time is when pretty much African-Americans moved east of Troost, and that kind of pattern remained the same all through the 20th century.
Historic Kansas City homes, that's our topic. We're talking about houses built between 1885 and 1938. Let's go to a different home here, one I'm familiar with because I teach up at UMKC. A lot of students will recognize the Walter Dickey residence, as known today as Schofield Hall. You know, walking through that thing these days, you almost can't believe it used to be a house.
Well, you have to look at the details in it, because inside, if you look at the architectural details, you can really tell that it is. I mean, some of the rooms, like where the drawing room is and the reception room, they built partial walls to it, so you really can't see the whole thing. But you can look at the mantelpieces and the decorative detailing on the walls. And the great two-story Great Hall has been painted over, but it was originally done in a con stone, which is a stone from France. And then also you look at the Language Center, which is a oak panel living room. It has this wonderful Italian Renaissance mantelpiece. And the interesting thing about one of the interesting things about the Dickey House is that the kitchen, dining room, and butler's pantry were on the top floor so that the heat wouldn't rise to the house and the odors wouldn't rise. They put it on the top floor. It's very interesting.
That's interesting. I mean, this place features seven chimneys, two elevators, a pool, and again, you just mentioned the kitchen and cook's quarters on the third floor. How unusual was all that? Well, what you've described earlier, it sounds like it was very unusual.
It was unusual as far as the kitchen on the top floor. It's rarely ever done. But I think they wanted, again, the heat. Kitchen odors would go up because of the heat in the house, and the family just didn't want that, or Dickey did not want that. So that's why they put it on the top floor. And that made it particularly unusual. It just didn't, that's the only house in Kansas City that I can find like that, a substantial house like this. Yeah.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Angela from Kansas City, Kansas. Angela, good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks.
I just wanted to comment about J.C. Nichols and racially restrictive covenants.
Right.
I think we're not being critical enough with our history if we just say, you know, that was something that was happening all over the country. You know, it's unfortunate, but everywhere people of color went, you know, they would have been restricted to, you know, slums and outer parts of cities. J.C. Nichols was instrumental in spreading racially restrictive covenants all over the country. He was influential on federal policy. You know, he really masterminded it. It wasn't a natural phenomenon. It was something that he really played a large part in spreading.
Angela, I appreciate that. Michael?
Yeah, Angela, I understand that, but what I'm speaking of I'm not supporting it. I'm just speaking about it from a historical context of it. So, and I totally agree with you. It is totally regrettable. But the research that I do, I just simply state the facts. And then it's up for interpretation. But basically, I agree with you.
Again, Michael speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Plaza Branch. Again, the event is sold out, but you can get more information about the book, Kansas City Houses. Just go to kansascityhouses.org. And Michael, what a pleasure to have you here. You know a lot of stuff.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much, sir. You can catch my conversation yesterday with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. Just find it at kcur.org/up-to-date. We discussed her tight, tight reelection campaign against Republican Josh Hawley. That was yesterday on KCUR's Up-to-Date. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up-to-Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, Democrat Laura Kelly is running for the governor's office in Kansas. We'll sit down with the current state senator and discuss the three-way race in that state. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.